There's one thing I'm dreaming about, and that is we need to find some damn connection with Islam and all of us. And it was always Sufism. It's the only part of Islam that's really interesting that connects with the rest of the world and creates the idea of a universal religion. Islam's own claims towards being a universal religion are unfortunately totally, you know, deaf and blind to reality. It's just, no. Reciting the Quran in Arabic.
I agree with you. Sufism is very important, yeah.
I think Sufism is absolute key. I think Tantric Buddhism is key. Sufism is key. We should definitely have some kind of dialogue with Taoists, and we love experts in Taoism and find that that's definitely well, to connect with the Chinese, there has to be connection with Taoism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
We can get this whole pattern together over the next, say, 5 to 10 years, and so much can be done.
What I like about this, what you're saying here is it's a world. You're saying it, you know, you're including the whole world. You know, when you hear about, a lot of people are just talking about the West or something, or at least Peterson, and it's always about the West.
I tell you, when nobody in Asia talks about the West, they talk about the East. So, I mean, if you're going to have a dialogue with the Chinese and the Indians, we can't sit in our own heads and be American.
It's a sort of idea the West is superior because it's so economically prosperous. I don't know.
It is not. It couldn't even keep its own damn empires together simply because those empires are built on boyish ambitions of plundering the world. No, the civilized empires in history was the Persian Empire, and even the Mongol Empire was way better than any of the European empires because the Mongols were bloodthirsty and they were ruthless. But once they conquered all the territory that they did conquer, they copied their model from the best of the Persian and the Chinese emperors, and they created the libertarian empire with a low tax rate, and they were actually popular. The reason why the Mongol Empire fell apart in the 14th century was because of the plague. It wasn't because of a lack of popularity. We can learn a lot from the Mongol Empire. We can learn a lot from the Persian Empires, three of them, that's for sure. We can certainly learn a lot from the Chinese Empires too. But when it comes to the short period, when England and France and Holland and Germany and Portugal and Spain conquered the world and plundered it for all humanity and plundered it, we call that colonialism. It fell apart with the First World War in a terrible disaster. Fravaka speaks very well about this. He understands definitely of the disaster the Europe became. Yeah. These short-lived,
okay, small great.
Built on shipping failed.
I want to stop you because I want you to keep talking about this because I have a friend, Cordula Fay, and she wanted you to talk about specifically Europe, right? For her.
Oh, we love her, by the way.
She wants to talk about. She's doing a magazine next month on Europe, and she specifically asked me a few times. You have to talk to Bard about Europe. So, where do we begin in speaking about Europe?
Well, what Europe really needs is a wake-up call, but it has to start with the rewriting of European history. And I don't mean to rewrite it like the Europeans were the perpetrators of the world and they were the rapists of the other continents and all that. No, it's more like we can more like be intra-European and look inside and just realize that the empires we created had no functioning ideology. They were basically trade empires built by a few trading companies that cynically exploited the world, driven by very boyish, infantile fantasies about conquering the rest of the world, driven by racist, stupid myths, blatantly untrue. And that's why, if you compare to, say, the Persian Empire, and how the Persians set the Jews free in Babylon and asked them to return to Jerusalem in the second Exodus to create the nation of Israel, so that could be a model nation within the Persian Empire. Now, if the European empires had understood that's how you build the proper empire, an authentic empire, if you're authentically phallic, instead of the false phallic empires the Europeans created, who plundered the world and actually fell apart. Now, they weren't all bad. You know, we did export the printing press to the rest of the world. We eventually export industrialization to the rest of the world. And finally, at the end of the 20th century, the rest of the world was playing catch up. And you know, people aren't starving on a level they used to do 50 years ago any longer. And we moved hundreds of millions of people out of poverty around the world. Or at least they have moved themselves out of poverty, to be honest about it. But we had to get around the whole problem of European colonialism to get there. And in this process, Europe hasn't found its own soul again. And now, when even the British Empire, the last remnants of the British Empire, Britain itself, is falling apart, maybe it's time for the Europeans to wake up, you know, and realize we have to read our own history and see Europe as a part of the world that now has to be an active, living part of the world and not some kind of dead fort that isolates itself and goes into, you know, an economic downward spiral with only old people in it and no youth, no new fresh ideas, no radical ideas at all. The only guy out there I like him, and that's Emmanuel Macron. And I might disagree with him on many points, but the damn guy is at least reforming France. And it must be fiendishly difficult to reform a conscious France, that France has sort of fallen into its crisis slowly over decades and become this sort of monolith that hardly moves, slow economic growth, conservatism. They don't want to learn English. They don't want part of the world. And we love France, right? We understand why. Because once you come to France, you get served all those crazy great dinners and you go to the coast and all that and wonderful climate. You know, I love the horses of Normandy and you probably love other aspects of France. You damn live there. I mean, it's a great country to live in. But it's becoming a parrot of itself, and Italy even more so. Italy is now nothing but a postcard that produces nothing of export value any longer. And it's just a tourist destination, hardly anything else. Now, that's tragic.
Yeah, well, I see that in the arts, actually. It's like, you know, cinema was very alive in Italy and in France in the 50s and 60s. And what's going on? The problem is
that the old institutions that must die are the strongest in Europe. That means the Europeans still believe in political institutions. The European Union is a really weird construction that never had much popularity to begin with. Maybe it does now after Boris Johnson. I don't know. But okay. Political institutions, academic institutions, they're terrible in Europe. They're underfunded. They pack in too many students. They don't teach anybody anything. But people still believe in them. It's like the Europeans are so stuck in the Cartesian mythology of Europe being so damn brilliant and civilized that they believe so strongly in these institutions, they don't see anything else. The best parts of Europe to go to are the parts where the old institutions are weakest. That's why I love the Baltic states. That's why I love Central and Eastern Europe way more than I love Western Europe. I'm much more inspired in a place like Kiev, Ukraine, or in Tbilisi, Georgia today than I would be inspired in Paris or London. Because the more you can get away from Oxford and Cambridge and Sorbonne and the old academic institutions, the old political parties, political institutions of France and the UK, and the more you can get away from those systems, the more freely you can think, the more digital you can be, the more vertical you can be in your ideas.
Mm-hmm. Vertical, why?
Well, just take a place like, say, Hamburg, right? Mm-hmm. It's a wealthy city.
Yeah.
Old money. Germany still runs well. They do their stuff well. You know, they still make car parts for Chinese electric cars or whatever, but they still do well export-wise. Okay. Respectfully, so Hamburg is one of the wealthiest cities on the planet, but they don't dare to build anything high because they're all conservative and they're all old. Hamburg is a city where people are on average 70 years old and they play golf clubs and they eat French dinners and, you know, drink French wines and things. And they're very conservative. They don't like change. They don't want to change anything. And all you think is that, why don't they just go to Dubai and Singapore and get some damn inspiration?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's
Dubai and Singapore is much sexier than boring old Hamburg. Because they're phallic and they have life to them. It's just boring in Hamburg. Dull. Dead.
What about Stockholm?
It's somewhere in between. At least the great thing with Scandinavia is the cultures here are as young. It's a bit like Canada, right? Yeah. The cultures of Scandinavia are at least as young as North America. Because, you know, except for, it was with Lutheranism that Sweden finally arrived on the map. Before that, yeah, they had a brief period when it was warm in the north and the Vikings basically plundered the earth and did some slave trade with the Russians and some slave trade with the English, right? But you know, we had a short period of the Vikings, but the period when Scandinavia finally arrived on the map was the period when Sweden was a superpower, and that was when Protestantism needed some bastion somewhere to build from. Since that couldn't be Germany, because Germany was just wrecked into pieces by the 30-year war, it became Sweden. Okay, Scandinavia arrived on the map. And since then, Scandinavia sort of tried to find its place on the map, but it's a much more youthful and much more open culture than Central Europe. So changes in Sweden occur way faster than they do in France or Italy. Sociological changes, new fashions, new ideas are being tried. The lifestyle experiments we're doing in Stockholm aren't heard of in the rest of Europe. With the possible exception of Berlin and Copenhagen, nobody dares to live the kind of lives we live in Stockholm at the moment. This is also interesting. This also points toward the future. So, you know, but at the end of the day, the future is digital and vertical. It's not horizontal. It's not about territory. It's not about conquering territory any longer. That ended in 1959. It's all vertical and digital from now on. And I look for anywhere out there where people dare to build skyscrapers right now and dare to do shit. That's the place to go. That's where the sexy shit happens. And in places where everybody's taken to court as soon as they have a new idea, are bad places to be. That's what most of Europe is like today. America is certainly like that today. If anybody has a new idea in the United States, if anybody has a new idea in Europe, people take you to court and sue you for it, and they drag you to the court, and they stop your idea from happening, and they're all NIMBYs. Not in my backyard. Europe is full of NIMBYs. It's full of these people.
It must be worse in not to be devil's advocate, but in Russia or in Singapore, having new ideas.
Well, in Russia, it all falls apart. Russia and Brazil, it falls apart because of the corruption of the systems. Yeah. And they have sort of vulgar amateur versions of these institutions that I'm attacking. I'm basically attacking all the institutions involved in the nation state. Ironically, I want to save them until we have something better, but I'm attacking them because in the long run, they cannot stay. So we need new institutions. We need new institutions of truth. Mm-hmm. We need new institutions of executive power. And we need new institutions of legislative power. So we need new institutions.
Mm-hmm. And the European institution doesn't cut it.
No, because they're not digital. Mm-hmm. Okay. Everything being done in Europe right now is all about stopping, preventing digital from happening, taxing it, killing it. Mm-hmm. Europe doesn't like genetically modified food. Well, fuck you. It's great. Europe doesn't like nuclear power because they're a populist and Angela Merkel is burning coal instead. Bad idea, Angela. You're killing the planet. Angela Merkel is one of the worst criminals when it comes to climate crime ever. She closed down the power plant, nuclear power plants in Germany, and turned on the coal plants instead. Terrible, Angela. Terrible idea. So to be an ecotopian today, you're not going to Europe to find the solutions. You really don't. That's why Europe is full of environmentalists, and they're not going to save the planet. The guys that are going to save the planet are going to be South Korean engineers, and they're going to be people out there in the world who create the solutions to the problems. So we, with the use of technology and machine intelligence, can save the planet. Because the machine intelligence will be told it needs to be our Messiah and save us. Mm-hmm. That means it needs to save the planet. It needs to create trade and communication between human beings so they don't kill each other any longer.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
For that to happen, we need to leave Europe right now. It's not happening in Europe. The total lack of imagination and the institutional resistance against change in Europe is enormous. And people who call themselves radical in Europe are not radical at all. They're basically NIMBYs, environmentalists. They call themselves green or whatever. They're just Rousseauian, backward-looking conservatives. Why are we still putting our junk in different boxes? Mm-hmm. That will be the first thing machine intelligence would solve for us. Throw everything in one place, the machine takes care of it. Now, if the machines in Europe don't even take care of our own garbage in 2019, Europe is so damn behind on technology that I don't see Europe having any of the solutions to the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. That has to be invented somewhere else. Probably India, Korea, another place, but not in Europe. We talk about dead religion. We talk about dead philosophy. We talk about dead culture.
Yeah.
Culture of death. Culture of golf clubs and conservatism. That's another threat. That's one of the three. The other two, of course, the two opponents, there are the Rousseauians today, the alt-right and the alt-left. But the third one,
oh yeah,
the conservatism of a rapidly aging society with screwed demographics, where only old people vote and old people have all the power and old people control politics. They control academia and they control industry. Okay. And they're not going to do anything to find solutions to the current problems. They're just going to go into moralizing, become church ladies, and be terrified of anything new and of change.
Okay. So we're talking about an extreme lack of vitality here.
Mortido.
Yeah. Okay.
The demographic death cult. So
what about the rise of nationalism and all that and blah, blah, blah? You told me that you wanted to, one of the things that you wanted to talk about was why you have public debates with people on the alt-right and alt-left.
Well, I did do two things this summer.
Wild, tantric, all these people who are, Jordan Hall is a good expression, a good opinion. They're people who are not in with good opinion. And it occurred to me that the people I like are almost never good opinion people, right?
No, exactly, because they make you think.
What? Right, yeah. They.
And they're often voices from
the future. They're alive. That's what I like about you. It's like it's something very alive, which you don't find in good opinion. You find this. You said Martito, but you find this. You find cliche and all these, just don't find anything going on. So
PowerPoint presentations.
So interested in these wacky people that,
Well, I did do this one thing this summer. Okay, beginning of the summer, I had a debate in Swedish with the Swedish alt-right leader. I hope he doesn't mind if I call him that, called Gustav Kasselstrand. Now, so far, he has not succeeded in creating a parliamentary party in Swedish politics. But the guy is incredibly charismatic and he's an ultra-nationalist. And I'm sure he's going to be very successful in Sweden in the 2020s. All you need is a little financial crisis, and, a few less jobs out there, and Kasselstrand will be very, very popular. So, okay, I don't want to be an enemy with this guy. I'd like to be his friend. I'd like to be in a constant dialogue and conversation with the guy. And it turns out he respects me as a philosopher. So I invited him for a debate. We talked for 2.5 hours in front of a packed auditorium in a hotel in Stockholm, put it online, and the next day there were 100,000 views in 24 hours.
Yeah.
This was during the European Union elections in Sweden. Not that he or I were even close to winning that election or anything like that at all. But this was by far the debate during the election campaign that all young Swedes loved the most. Okay, so why is that? Well, okay, because it's an interesting conversation between a nationalist, Gustav Kasselstrand, and a cosmopolitanist, Alexander Bard.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So what I did was that I honored him for his nationalism, found common ground during the debate. For example, that we live in the middle of a Heideggerian existentialist crisis. Kasselstrand is a big fan of Jordan Peterson and these guys out there. He understands that we live in the middle of an existential crisis that established politics doesn't even deal with, or even less so understands and ignores arrogantly. Okay, so we agreed on that. There's a Heideggerian existential crisis going on in society. People feel lost. There are the masses out there, an ignorant, arrogant elite that deserves to have his ass kicked and maybe even deserves to have its heads chopped off.
Yeah.
Fine, we agreed on that. But then I challenged him and said, but the problem with you is that I believe in phallic vision. And what is your phallic vision? And Kasselstrand couldn't say anything about what Sweden would be like 50 years from now, except he didn't like the idea that people who walked down the street would be too dissimilar from himself.
Yeah.
I said, well, why do you base that on? And then he said, well, look at Iceland. Okay, Iceland has been a nation state for 1,000 years and, we kept Aryan clean or whatever. He didn't say that, but, Iceland is sort of the successful Northern European country. And I said, well, to begin with, it's a very cold part of the world and hardly anybody ever goes there. Maybe that protected Iceland for 1,000 years. But if you honor Iceland for having been a nation for 1,000 years, then Rome has existed for 3,000 years and Cairo has existed for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
We've got a much better, more sustainable model for the future. And that's called the city, the world city, the cosmopolitan city. That's why I'm a cosmopolitanist. So I believe in cosmopolitanism simply because it's a better ideology than nationalism, simply because it's more sustainable. It's better for human beings to live in large cities and be segregated and have their Chinatowns and have their Jew towns and have their Persian towns or whatever, trade in between these townships, and then create a digital model of that, which is the internet. And then you don't have to have any territory that's just transport territory. You only need the territory people actually need to be and to live and to act. Now, that's the model for the internet. That's the model for the city. Okay. And he admitted that actually I had a phallic vision. And we're moving towards a world where everybody will be connected with everybody else. So they will create a digital world that is definitely cosmopolis. And to this cosmopolis, we can then attach cosmopolitan values. And then I honored him again and said, but listen, Gustav, you're right about one thing. We're only tribal. And the priesthoods throughout history have fooled us to go from tribe to clan, from clan to nation. And it's taken them thousands of years to fool us into believing we can be nationalist and meet people who speak and talk and write like us and actually share something with them. But now we have to fool people even one step further and go from nation to empire. And I honored him and said, that's what I'm working on. That's my job as a philosopher, is to try to convince you that your nation could work within an empire. And then I just said, you're not into anti-Semitism, are you? No. I like the Jews, I like the Israelis. Like, great. Okay. That's out of the ultra I'd actually talk to, because I love the Israelis and I love the Jews and I love the Palestinians. And I love the Jews precisely because they're the ultimate nationalists, and I love the Palestinians because they're the ultimate cosmopolitanists.
Yeah, I said that before.
If you want to build empire, Palestinians are great. If you want to build nation, Jews are great. So we left it at that, left the rest of the audience to decide for themselves. It went viral and people went berserk. Unfortunately, it's in Swedish. You have to understand Swedish. But at the end of the summer, I then went for another guy that's sort of been chastised and thrown out, you know, in the margin of society, but who I actually think is a figure of the future. And that's Alexa Varkman. Formerly mostly known as Alex Varkman, these days mostly known as Alexa Varkman. Now, this is a very interesting character, an androgynous character, man's man who can be a woman.
I had heard nothing but bad things about him, so.
That's a good sign.
Yeah.
That's a good sign. If you only hear bad things about somebody, but they're still popular, that means they're rock and roll and probably they're onto something. Okay. That's called crazy wisdom in Tantric Buddhism. And that's why Alexa Varkman is a modern tantric crazy wisdom teacher. Mm-hmm. A very polite one, I must say. Also one who admits his or her mistakes and insight. And so what we did was that at the beginning of August, we recorded a civilized conversation in a small flat in Copenhagen. We met halfway between Amsterdam and Stockholm, met in Copenhagen, and had a little team of a few guys who just recorded us. Very simple amateurs like you and me now, we do our Zoom cast. And the sound isn't perfect, the picture isn't perfect, but who cares? There's a conversation for almost 2 hours between Alexander Bart, tantric philosopher, and Alexa Varkman, a tantric sexologist.
Yeah.
We're talking about tantra, we're talking about sexuality, we're talking about sex, it's different from sexuality. We talk about crazy wisdom, and we're talking about why we're both working in complete and utter minefields.
Hold on, why is, you said something that we can't, why is sex different than sexuality?
Sex is what you share with animals. Sexuality is exclusive for human beings.
Okay.
Just remember that. Anything that has to do with sex that animals would also do is sex.
Mm-hmm.
Like the intercourse itself, etc. Okay. Sexuality, all these crazy ideas we have
in your mind as well. It's also
in sexuality, right? Okay. Animals do not have sexuality, they only do sex.
Right.
We have a sexuality. And it's never harmonious, it's never balanced, it's never easy, it's always a minefield. And that's exactly what all these Rousseauian social justice warriors love to walk around in sex. Sex and climate are the two favorite topics because they're the top hottest topics out there. Climate right now, because it's trendy, sex is always a hot topic and always a minefield and can never be right. It can never be balanced, never harmonious, always a minefield. That means I called Alexa Varkman when Me Too started. And I called not only Varkman, I basically called every tantra guru I knew of in North America, in Europe and Asia, and warned them and said, this Me Too thing is not gonna be over until they've gone after every tantra guru on the planet, because every tantra guru on the planet has some dissatisfied female customer. They've had some.
Tantra guru on the planet is male.
And I will go after them now and say that I didn't become beautiful and get fucked properly, although I learned everything from my tantra gurus. I'm gonna blame it all on him, right? And that's exactly what Me Too was all about. Bitter, unfucked women in large quantities, right? So I warned Varkman, and then Varkman was dragged through the mud last fall and then called me and said, listen, my heart is broken. people that I love, they're going after me because they totally fucked up by this Me Too thing. And it's just a mess. And you told me this part. You warned me. And I said, thank you. Yes, I warned you. I warned you what happened. Now we need to prepare how we're going to handle this and what we're going to do next. And one of the benefits that Bartman and I have is that we've been friends for years, intrigued and fascinated with each other, but also decided not to walk into each other's territory. So he's declared to everybody, the TNT, the New Tantra Movement, that Bart is not going to be a member of the Tantra Movement. We need a few good friends outside of our community that we can actually deal with that could be helpful in the future. That's exactly where I step in. And I always say the same thing to Bart, you're not going to be part of the men's movement that I work with or any of the products that I work with, because you do your thing over there, I do my thing over here. And by keeping the two things separate, we can maintain a brotherhood or brosterhood, as we call it now, and a friendship. So we had this conversation. It's gone viral, and we're dating. I can think of a more beautiful and fascinating woman to date than a woman who's also been a man who's fucked thousands of women and figured out what the female mindset is like. And the only thing
it's true. When I listened to that interview, I was impressed at how female he was during that interview.
He was. Yeah.
And almost you seemed abashed, and you don't seem abashed around me or other people I've seen, but with him, you seem kind of abashed. I don't know if I'm getting
Alexa Bartman is quite a character. Let's admit that. We dated in Brazil already in January, and that's why I got interested. But yeah, I understand that Bartman is a controversial figure, but so am I. So what? You know, does it mean that the people who go after us are right? No, of course they're not. We warned people along and said, I'm not a damn role model. Bartman never wanted to be anybody's role model. I always tell people I'm tantric, meaning that, you know, I'm crazy. There's no way you can live my lifestyle. It's so damn complicated and so weird that it's going to freak you out. So don't even try, okay? I'm a shaman in the forest. I'm crazy. I'm tantric, right? So I'm crazy wisdom. So is Bartman. That's why I think the dialogue worked. And at the end of the dialogue, I pointed out to Alexa Bartman, there's one thing left for you to do, because he's basically passed on the TNT to New Generation. They're building a tantric monastery in Holland where I'm an advisor. It's a brilliant product, by the way. Imagine you fly to Schiphol Airport and you drive 20 minutes somewhere, you walk into a beautiful building, and you're met by the world's leading most professional sexologist who's going to fix your sex life for you. Now, they're going to have to charge for that. If anybody in the world should charge,
I can't afford that.
Money for being consulted, it's got to be the Tantric Monastery in Holland. But those guys over there, Paris Gray, Chris Clark, all the people who work there, these young, beautiful, wonderful, sexy sexologists, I love them all. So does Bartman. But Bartman has passed it on to them. So the question was, is Bartman anything left to do as a Tantric teacher? And I said, there's one thing that Alexa Bartman will be the best teacher in the world, and that is to really teach women and how to be liberated in their female sexuality. I can't think of a better teacher in the world than having a session, a closed session for a few hours with Alexa Bartman, teaching women what it likes to really be a woman and fully embrace your femininity sexually. And Bartman agreed. Mm-hmm. She's already moving there as Alexa Bartman. Alex Bartman is not going to teach him longer. You're going to see Alexa Bartman teaching women and really fully accomplish female liberation, female sexual liberation. I can't think of a better feminist than Bartman. Mm-hmm. Because he goes straight to the embody, and what he's really practicing and wants to practice is embodied feminism. Mm-hmm. Terrifies men, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I love it. I think this is contemporary Tantra in its best possible form. Coming out of crazy wisdom people who are weird and crazy. Well, if you want a role model rather than a teacher, you go for Sutra. If you want a teacher, you go for somebody who's really crazy and wicked.
The Tantric teacher I know told me that you have to become fully male and fully female in the Tantric path. You have to become both.
Exactly.
Perhaps
that's what Bartman is. That's what I admire about Bartman. He really is an embodied, full, androgynous, 100% man, 100% woman character, and works himself or herself towards that goal. And I think it's quite amazing. And I see somebody embodying something that I make theory out of. So we'll see where that dialogue ends. I think as for now, that was fine. like the Kazakhstan debate at the beginning of the summer. I don't have anything more to say to Kazakhstan now. I'm only going to return to him and challenge him again when I have more stuff to talk about in defense of cosmopolitanism, which is, of course, where my heart is.